of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful, sunny California. Thanks for tuning into the Water Zone today. I'm Rob Starr, and our co-host, Mr. Chris Davey, is on vacation. He was going to call in, but he's in a dead zone for his cell phone, so he's not going to be joining us today. But we do have two great guests. It's a beautiful day out here in California. It's mid-80s, beautiful sunlight, clear skies, and we like the weather and hope it stays that way. So we're going to go right to our first guest, and that is the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, Ms. Chris Austin, for the best water news in California. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Good. It's just you and me, baby, today.
Oh, all right.
Well, that's good. It makes a good show.
I'll miss the other Chris.
Miss the other Chris. Yeah, he did. We've been communicating. He was moving to a different campsite today, and he was afraid he couldn't get a signal. And I said, Chris, it's your vacation. Do not call in. We can handle this. So so he's done. I told him we got a professional running the show, which is you, and it will work very well. So I'm not worried about that at all. Anyway, a couple good things are interesting things that are happening in the news, and I guess California's new natural resources secretary takes on the challenge of implementing Governor Newsom's ambitious water agenda, and that gentleman is Mr. Wade Crowfoot, and he was a past person who was on our show, and when he was the advisor in agriculture to Governor Brown. But so how do you think that's going to work out?
Well, you know, Wade is a great guy, by
yes.
the way. Oh, I mean, he's full of personality, dynamic, ton of energy.
And he gets stuff done.
I think he's going to do a great job. What I find curious is, you know, the word ambitious, water agenda, I think that was something that, you know, the people who wrote that article kind of put in. I mean, I think in terms of, you know, Brown's water ambitions and Newsom's water ambitions, I think he has some different things. And I think he's also putting his efforts into other areas of the state besides water that really need attention, like housing, for one.
Yep, absolutely.
And, you know, disadvantaged communities. So I am not necessarily sold on the ambitious word, but it's interesting to kind of get a look at what's ahead. And, you know, clearly we see that he wants to do something about disadvantaged communities and the poor drinking water, and that's great. We're all kind of waiting to see what he's going to do with the tunnel project. He has said one tunnel, and I joke. I said, you know, well, he didn't say what size, right? He won, you know, 15,000 CFS, one really big tunnel, right?
Yeah.
But no, the idea is that it's going to be a smaller tunnel, and he, you know, he wants to do something about the salt and sea, and I think that's, you know, we talked about that last week, and stuff needs to be done. So I think he does have, you know, water's on his list of things to do, and he has some things, but I don't think his water agenda is quite as ambitious as Governor Brown's, and you know, it's probably time that people focus on maybe some other things. I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, water, it should be water all the time, right? But sometimes there's other things.
Right. So. I agree. I know Mr. Crawford is an excellent guy, very knowledgeable. He does have a persistent passage for getting things accomplished, and that's a good thing. I think they need that in the administration. I know they made the change with him and also the person in charge of the DWR and the State Water Resources Board. So hopefully we'll see some more action and getting more things done, which will be really, really cool.
Hey, yeah, and I think, you know, one thing about Wade is he's super likable. He's energetic. And he's funny, and it those are the kind of qualities that I think it sort of takes to, you know, bring people together and kind of, you know, cajole them into cooperating a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a fun guy to be around, so the people are going to be drawn to him and be likely that he'll be able to get some things accomplished.
Yeah, he's very well down to earth. You know, he reaches out to everybody. He has a good personality, and I think he's a good guy for the job. And I'm glad he's there. Hey, I also heard that there's some a bunch of dead fish washing up on this near this passageway.
Yeah, you know, there's this spot up there in Sacramento in the Yolo Bypass called the Fremont Weir, and it has been a problem. I mean, the Fremont Weir is part of the Sacramento Flood Control System, and it works, like, beautifully. It's actually, it was created in the early 1900s, and it's a model for how cities can protect themselves against floods, and all that's great. But it kind of is not so great for the fish when they get flows into the Yolo Bypass, which is, you know, the flood flows. They go that would otherwise inundate Sacramento now go into the Yolo Bypass. And that's a flood bypass, so it's graded to drain very quickly. That's the whole idea. They farm it during the summer, and in the winter, everyone clears out, and it's a flood control bypass. There's no buildings, there's no homes in the Yolo Bypass. It's not allowed. It's part of the flood control system.
Right.
So, you know, the water comes down, and then when the river levels drop, the water drains out of the Yolo Bypass very quickly. And now we have salmon coming up into the system, coming up into the Sacramento River, trying to get up to spawn, and they get trapped in behind this, you know, behind the weir in the flood control system. So they usually have to send people in and try and save a bunch. So this has been a problem for literally decades, and so they finally came together and they created a canal, or what they thought was a fix for the problem. But it didn't work quite as intended, and they lost some fish. They did go through the canal and get the other fish in there. It wasn't as bad as it could have been, but, you know, when we're talking about endangered salmon and there's not all that many left, it's very distressing when they get killed for something like that, especially when this is a project that was meant to prevent this.
Right.
So, you know, they're going to go in and study and try and figure out what happened and how they can modify it to make it work. But, you know, unfortunately, sometimes we think we know what we're doing. We think it's going to work, but something happens and it doesn't. So, it's very sad. Unfortunately, you know, that's kind of the way it works with, you know, science. So hopefully they can figure it out and tweak it, because it was, you know, $6.3 million canal, I believe, that they built.
Yep.
So, you know, but that's, you know, now they just have to fix it, and hopefully we won't have that problem next year. So
We hope so. Hey, you know, with the things that happen, like the wildfires and that tour across California, especially the, I'm trying to remember the name of that one, the Tubbs Fire, I think that's the name of it. And I guess they got some other issues going on with the temperatures from those wildfires. They melted all the PVC water pipes.
They have contamination in the water system.
Yep.
Apparently what happened, it had something to do with when the firefighters are fighting the fires and they hook into the water system, and the pressure's changed and it sucks some of the fire and some of the stuff into the pipe, because all of a sudden water is going in a different direction, and it burns the pipes, and now they're finding they're going to have to do is replace the entire water system. I mean, there's no way to get this stuff out. It's like the pipe or the system has been changed by the fire.
Right.
And it's not like you can flush it and it's all gone.
It's benzene, which is a nasty chemical that's leaching out of the plastic PVC. That's part of what it's done. But
yeah.
God, that's going to be a mess to take care of now.
Oh, it's and extremely expensive.
Yep.
And really hard. I mean because now you have to redesign a water system. This is the kind of thing that's done, you know, before you develop a housing, a little subdivision, you design all this and you put it in and then you build your house. Now we have people that want to come back onto their properties and they want to rebuild. And, you know, the water system is going to have to be completely rebuilt. And who's going to pay for that? It's very expensive. And you can these homeowners that have lost everything and are trying to rebuild, they're not going to be able to afford a whole new water system.
No.
And it's going to tie up things. I mean, it's really a big issue.
What do you think about these power companies and such, where their equipment basically touched off some of these fires, and they're going to claim, well, we're going to go bankrupt unless, you know, the state helps them or something? I mean, what do we do? They're holding us for ransom. That I guess there was a bill passed a while back that the citizens are going to pay a fine or a tax, not a fine, but a tax or a fee to help offset that. I mean, so all the citizens are going to pay to do something that those water companies or the power companies should have had insurance for.
Yeah, well, I don't know. We have a lot of infrastructure, a lot of power lines that cross a lot of wild land.
Yep.
I don't know what you did. They passed the law and they said, okay, we're making you responsible. So the next wind event comes and the power companies say, okay, wind event, we're shutting off your power.
Mm-hmm.
So all these people then are screaming, you shut off our power. You know, we didn't have power for 24 hours. Our food's rotted. We can't work. You know, people on medical things. So it's sort of like for the power companies, they're sort of damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like it's a really tough issue.
Well,
I think it tends to make people mad when it's an investor-owned utility,
right,
versus a public utility, because they seem to feel like, you know, like the investors should pay for it.
Yeah.
And maybe you don't give them dividends on their stock or something, but I mean, in the long run, when things like this happen, I don't know. It's really a difficult situation. I understand, man, everything got lost and you know, you lose everything, burned to the ground, you got all these impacts. But I'm not sure how much power companies can do to prevent things happening to all these power lines.
Aren't they
winds are increasing, you know, we're having more extreme weather events.
Correct.
You know, who knows what's going to happen.
Well, don't you think that, this is my belief, if you have a medical condition where you need the power on, for people have BiPAPs and CPAP machines or oxygen, you know, all of these kind of things they got to be hooked to. I don't know why there can't be some sort of, and I would possibly agree to this, is that some sort of subsidy that helps give them a battery backup so they can power that kind of stuff on and keep them alive. I think that's an important thing. I think that the utility companies, if they know where their power lines run through, you know, you said some barren land or some forest land, why can't they have crews going out and do tree trimming and get rid of all the dead trees that are in there? I mean, that needs to be harvested out. That's a big deal. I mean, all these fires, look at how much dead wood there was in the forest to catch on fire.
Yeah, I mean, that's the flip side to it is, you know, how much can you hold the power companies responsible for when they can't necessarily maintain the land that's around them? I mean, they have an easement,
right?
But they can't, you know, they can't go onto federal forest land and make changes. So, I mean, there's a lot of things, you know, that need to be paid attention to, especially, you know, cleaning up the forest.
Yeah, I would hope everybody, and I don't mean just the utilities company, but everybody learned a lesson about what happened here, and that they should really have a serious committee to write down on a, you know, almost like have what I call a Kaizen event, where they put down everything on paper of what the issue is and what are the possible, you know, what are the root causes and what's the possibilities to fix the things and implement that, because we need to know that. I mean, otherwise it's going to keep repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating, and we certainly don't want to see that again. You know, I mean, look at all looks how it affected the housing. Look how it affected the water with the benzene in it. I mean, there's so many things that, and sometimes people can't even afford to rebuild their homes. And it doesn't take a couple months to build a home. It takes a long time to get it all back together.
Yeah, with permits and meanwhile, you got to live somewhere.
Right, and especially with these pipes, I don't see anybody rushing in to replace the whole water infrastructure so people can go back and live where they live. That's going to be incredible. Too much.
Yeah, and I mean, boy, I tell you, the housing market's pretty tight in Sacramento.
Yeah, yes.
You know, and in a lot of places in Northern California, you know, housing is a big issue in this state, and we've seen this last year, you know, tens of thousands of homes get burnt up. I read that as many houses as they built last year were burned.
Yep.
So we didn't add anything to the housing stock. And, you know, besides just houses, what we really need is affordable housing because not everybody can afford a $500,000 single-family home with 2,500 square feet and three bedrooms and three baths.
Well, if you listen to the politicians these days, they all say everybody's going to have everything. So I don't believe that, and I hope that doesn't happen. So we'll see. Hey, I also heard, and the reason I pick your brain on these things, because you know everything about what's going on here, the Delta smelt. I guess for the first time ever, a fish survey that was conducted every autumn by the state turned up zero Delta smelt they found.
Yeah, and actually, you know, this is not necessarily a news story.
Right.
Because that was last fall, and this particular writer writes about fish issues, and he wrote about it last fall. But it's a new article, a little bit extra stuff added in. So, yeah, we put it in there. Yeah, the Delta smelt is not in good shape. I mean, there is still apparently Delta smelt in the Delta. They're just in some odd areas.
Right.
And not necessarily areas where they've done these surveys in
right.
the past.
And
these are surveys that they've done since, like, the 1960s, and they go to certain specific spots and see where they are. So when you get a zero catch in any of these surveys, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're gone. They're just not in these usual places. Do not interpret that as that they're plentiful in other places. There aren't many of them around.
No.
I'm just saying there's few, but there may be some, not zero. We just didn't.
Yeah, I guess the writers want to stir up a little controversy about that. I know you and I a couple months ago talked about this. I told you I had been at a meeting with Metropolitan Water District, and they had another company come in and made an hour's presentation. The guy was an excellent scientist, and he said, you know, it depends where you go take the survey. It depends what the depth is that you go down to measure that. It also depends on the time of day and on the season where to do that. And his report was totally different than another company's report. And he was saying there's, you know, I don't remember the exact number. I'll call it gazillions of Delta smelt left. But what would happen if they did go away?
I'm
not trying to get rid of them. I'm just curious.
How important is Delta smelt to the ecosystem? I mean, to be honest, you know, it would be just probably another extinction in a long line of them. But I do think that it does bear concern, because if the waterways aren't habitable for fish, what does that really mean for the long run for the human people?
Right.
I mean, if fish can't live, that's not good for people. And it's not just the Delta smelt that are at risk, but there's also the salmon. I mean, and people say, well, we don't eat smelt, minnow, bait fish, all this stuff that they say. Okay, but salmon you do. And, you know, California salmon, you know, it used to be, you know, a staple, and there isn't much of it around now. And, you know, that's a concern. So, you know, should you be concerned about the smelt? No, maybe not, I guess, depending on how you look at it. But I think we all should be concerned about the salmon.
Yep, I totally agree. There's also, you know, that we read so much news about all these kind of things. I mean, this you start listing them, and it just list goes on and on forever. You know, there's disturbing levels of carbon dioxide likely to increase ocean acidity very fast, the scientists are saying. And so they're saying a lot of this is coming from climate change and agriculture and all the stuff they're dumping into the, you know, 25 million tons of carbon dioxide into the ocean every year.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, it's fascinating stuff in a sense. You know, and I think that the thing that I've kind of suspected, and I think we're finding out more and more, is that everything is connected to everything else, and not just in a small scale, but in a global scale. Last week, one of the more interesting stories was that when they have tropical storms in the tropics, like monsoons in India, that 2 weeks later there's a heat wave in the Central Valley.
Mm.
I mean, they've proven that there's this connection. Big storm in the tropics, heat wave in the Central Valley. It always follows 10 to 14 days later. I mean, the whole global system, it is a global system. We tend to look at it in parts, little pieces and parts that apply to us, but there are greater forces at work that are the whole globe.
Well, just like that volcano up in Washington when that thing exploded years ago, that stuff traveled all over the world.
Oh, it did. It did. And when other volcanoes blow in other places, that comes here too.
Yep.
You know, I mean, they have linked air pollution in China to storms that come in the Sierra Nevada. I mean, they found, like, dust from Asia in the Sierra Nevada mountains.
Wow.
You know, so it's like the world, it is. It's one global world. We're all connected by the atmosphere.
That's true. That is very true. Well, since you are the maven, and if somebody asks you, what are the top three issues today in California with water, that's related to water, how would you list the top three, in your opinion?
I think the most important thing I would think would probably be the voluntary settlement agreements that they're working on in the rivers in Northern California, because that's going to affect so many things. They're trying to get more habitat, some more water in the river, some money for science. So they're really trying to negotiate a deal, and I think that's important. And that's going to affect the Delta. And then this number two would have to be, I'd probably say it would be the Delta, because we have to address the problems that we're having there. But, you know, third, and not, you know, last but no, not necessarily least by anything, I do agree that we need to do something about contaminated drinking water in the Central Valley and
Absolutely.
In the Salinas Valley and in the area. I mean, these are people who pick our food.
They're human beings.
I mean, whether they're here legally or illegally or whatever you want to say, these people provide a service we need. They pick our food and our vegetables. And I think the fact that they have to go home and get water coming out of their faucets that's worse than the water they see going on to their plants, I think that's bad.
I agree with you.
I'm really hoping that we see some real action on bringing some real solutions to that.
Yeah, I mean, end of the day, they're human beings, so we need to treat human beings like human beings, not like animals. And, you know, when you see these poor people, you know, getting disgusting water, contaminated water that they drink and give to their children, and it causes all kinds of defects and things. I mean, that's horrible. We as humans can't do that. So I think I like your three ideas. We can call next week. We'll call Wade up. Mr. Crowfoot,
yeah.
And we'll give him, he'll come back on the show and we can talk with him about those things and I'd like to get his opinion now that he's in that position versus doing the ag stuff. So anyway, Chris, it was wonderful having you on the show again. And again, we love you. Anybody who wants to know more about California water news, the one place to go, more than the Water Zone, is mavensnotebook.com. You can come, you can go there and be a sponsor of that, a contributor, and every day you'll get a delivery of information that'll really keep you informed about what's going on. So, Chris, thanks for joining us this week, and we'll catch you next week.
Okay, sounds
all right.
Great.
We're going to take a little break. We'll be back with our next guest, so stay tuned for version two.
CAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, K292 FQ Riverside, and K293 CF Moreno Valley.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. Eco Series products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fat-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fat-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco Solvent Cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
Back to the second half of the Water Zone, and we got some great guests coming up here. And I got an email the other day, and they were asking, a lot of people were sending in and said, where else can we hear you and so forth? So, you know, we're on NBC News Radio on 102.3 FM, KCAA 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, but we're also on Amazon Echo, Instagram, Spotify, TuneIn, Spreaker, Pandora, YouTube, KCAAradio.com, Ustream, Facebook, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, iTunes, Tiki Live, Podbean, TalkStream Live, and NBC Radio News. And we're also going to be getting to another one called Turfs Up Radio. That will start in a couple weeks, and the thing keeps growing and growing. We love the listeners that we have, and we thank everybody for doing that. You can also listen and watch us live. We broadcast live as well. So anybody's out there that's watching me, I'll give a wave and say hi. We'll move on to our next guest. We have a gentleman from the nice warm area of Canada. I don't know how warm it is there today. His name is Gary Fenton, and he's the president of a company called Maximum H2O, which we're all going to learn about. It's a pretty interesting company. So welcome, Gary. How are you doing today? Are you there? Gary? I don't hear Gary. We're searching and searching. The blue light's on, that he's on the thing, so I don't know where he went. And they're quickly searching for a signal, and we can't find him. do I have his phone number? Not handy with me. I'm sorry. If you look him up on the website, it's called Matt, but I don't know. He's probably calling from his home because it's disconnected. He's probably going to call back. It's 3 hours difference in Canada. Ah, here's a phone call. That must be him. Oh, we're just checking for him. Got a new engineer, and he's rushing to get this done, and I think it's going to be a thumbs up for us. And he's putting him on the air now. Hi, Gary. How you doing?
Heard nothing for a while, so I dialed back in.
Are you there?
I am.
Okay. Thank you. We lost you there for a second. We thought something happened, and I guess it did, but you're back with us. So for our listening audience, the name Maximum H2O, can you give us some background about the company and yourself and what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Thanks for having me on your program. Maximum H2O is a we develop a water conditioning product. I'm the president of the company. And I started out, actually, 30 years in computer science, so focused on technology and logic. And I started just researching water studies. There was a lot of work happening with European scientists. Mm-hmm. And I was following their works, and they were studying how various forces affected the behavior of water and the performance of water. So I started experimenting with different designs, and through years of trials, actually optimized the design and came up with a product that actually changes the behavior of water. And what it is, it uses a series of magnetic forces that work to reorient the molecular structure of water.
Well, I know there's lots of different technology about magnets and such, and I'm gonna be a little how should I say interesting in how I ask you these questions, but since our listeners may not be into the science end of it, we kind of want to talk a little bit about that. But the different types of magnets that are used, for what I've read, the neodymium is a magnet that's used a lot for water treatment. Is that the type that you would use, or do you have something different?
No, that's exactly what we use, and that's a permanent magnet. And the beauty there is, you know, there's many grades within that type of magnet,
right?
But we go with the strongest grade, N52 class. And it's a permanent magnet, meaning it will degrade less than 1% over 100 years.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It's incredible. It just keeps on working, and with no additional inputs, it really improves the performance of irrigation water.
Now, people would never believe or never think about how magnets can affect water. And you know, the magnets are what they call, I guess they call it diamagnetic. That to me is when you have two electrons that are paired together, or they're in orbital and their total spin equals zero. And for those who are not into the physics world, that's pretty interesting science about this. But it's really interesting how they can control and do things with water that people would never even realize that. It's interesting. So what's unique about your hydrodynamic magnetic resonance technology, and kind of how does it work without giving away the family jewels?
Yeah. So, you know, what happens with water molecules, the H2O molecule, they don't travel one by one. They actually bond together. It's a covalent bond that forms between these molecules. So the hydrogen of one molecule bond to the oxygen of a neighboring molecule, and they form these clusters. And the clusters grow in size, and they trap dissolved oxygen and toxins and various things within these clusters. But the real challenge is they become so large that they can no longer easily permeate through the cellular membrane of people, plants, or animals. So although there's water available, it's not necessarily bioavailable to the cells of the plant. That's most evident in things like hydroponic growing situations and greenhouses where the plant roots are submerged in water, but depending on if we treat the water with our system or it's just regular water, there's a night and day difference between the root growth and the availability of water and minerals, actually, to the plant. So what we do through a series of magnetic fields is overpower those covalent bonds, and that's called hydrogen bonding, is what happens between water naturally.
Mm-hmm.
We overpower that. We break down the molecules into very small elements that can easily pass through the cellular membrane and hydrate. And it, number one, it hydrates, but it also delivers more dissolved oxygen, nutrients, and flushes toxins from the cells.
There's a lot of sports drinks that I see that promote that they it's more oxygenated. Do they do that with magnetics, or they do it some other way?
It will expose more dissolved oxygen to your cells.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
And you know, it's and it results in healthier plants. You know, using less water, but we see an improvement in resistance to disease in insects and drought. You know, we'll develop better root system. We, you know, just getting the water further into the soil. But also, we've had customers in, for example, corn farmers in Kansas say that after putting the system on their pivot, they had no mite pressure anymore. The mites had just gone to the neighbor's field, I guess. But they had a real issue with mites and corn weevil. And after putting the unit on, the mite pressure just disappeared. Now, it may have something to do with the moisture content of the soil, but regardless, it was a very positive thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting when any individual who's not into this technology reads about it, they learn a whole bunch of things. I know that there's some physicists in Japan, they've discovered that the melting point, you'll love this, I'm sure you know this, the melting point of water increases slightly in strong magnetic fields. And it has, water has a lot of unusual properties, and it's relatively high melting and boiling points for small molecule. And the liquid state can also be denser than the solid state. And it was telling me that recently it was discovered that the near-infrared spectrum and refractive index of water can be affected by strong magnetic fields. And again, most people don't even know about things like this. They just think a magnet's a magnet. You can pick up nails that fell on the floor. You can play with, you know, they sell these things at the state fairs. You can buy these magnet kits that you can build little objects with because they all stick together. I mean, but beyond that, most people don't understand the power of magnetics and what it can do.
You know, and we're still discovering that today. These scientists keep coming out with discoveries on how it has an impact on the water and the performance of the water. So it's a work in progress. We're just now understanding that it can have such an impact on irrigation, on agriculture, and many other places as well.
Oh, yeah.
It was interesting. Some of the early space shuttle voyages and the space station, the astronauts would come down and they'd have a significant reduction in bone density.
Mm-hmm.
And NASA thought, well, it was gravity deprivation.
Right.
What it actually turned out to be was magnetic field deprivation.
Wow.
So there's all sorts of impacts, and I'm focused on agriculture and turf, but let the scientists continue to explore.
Well, magnets, I know, are used, or at least sometimes used in the medical business industry for healing tennis elbow and things like that. There's been things that I've seen that do that. And also that salt solutions also has a faster rate of flowing the water versus a standard tap water when it's in a magnetic field. So again, there's so many things that are unique about this. So going back to your stuff, does using your system result in a lot of water savings, and how does that do that?
Yeah, that's probably one of the key benefits. Because we break the water down and reduce the molecular cluster group size, we actually break the surface tension, and the water can actually permeate into the soil easier. So we see, on average, a reduction in 20 to 30% water savings.
Wow,
we've had some sites report much higher numbers, but you know, I'm very comfortable with the 20 to 30. That's what I would expect most customers to see. And the key factors in optimizing this water utilization are improved permeation, a reduction in runoff, a reduction in evaporation, and increased bioavailability to the plant. You get the water into the ground, you increase the soil moisture holding capacity and make it able to actually permeate through into the plant. You use a lot less water.
Wow. Certainly can use that around the world, especially in the ag world. And for turf, because everybody's, you know, they want to tear your turf out. You don't need it, and, you know, and we need turf. It produces oxygen, does a whole lot of different things. So we talked a little earlier about how these technology can reduce the scaling in salts, and can you get a little bit more deeper on how that's achieved, and does it matter on the strength of the magnet, and how is this thing put together, your system? Is it go through some nozzles? Is it through an injector or a chamber? How does that all, just for our listeners who are trying to figure out what you got?
Yeah, the smaller devices, you know, up to 2 inch in pipe diameter, are basically a thread-on coupling. Looks something like a backflow preventer. Threads right in line. There's a series of magnets around within the unit itself. And as the water passes through, it gets restructured. The larger units that would go in a pump station or a pivot or a golf course pump station would be the probes are mounted on a stainless steel flange, and they sit right inside within the flow of the water. Now, you asked about scaling and salts. Not only do what we do is the same process that breaks down the hydrogen bonding within the molecules changes the structure of the minerals. So the minerals are still there. A lot of people say, well, how does your filter work? It's not a filter. If you had calcium in your water before, you still have calcium in the water now, but we change the structure so it can't build up in the way of mineral scale. And another nice thing, we'll actually reverse the buildup of pre-existing scale.
Mm-hmm.
So we mobilize minerals, we convert them into very fine particles, keep them in solution, and they're available for the plant as nutritionals.
And it's all non-chemical based. It's a good non-chemical alternative to what goes. So when these things pass through, and as you say, these are threaded on, does it matter how what the flow rate is and the time it takes to pass through the magnets or flow over that? I mean, does it have to get processed for a certain amount of time, or is this instantaneous? You're flowing gallons or liters a minute through this thing?
Yeah, no, they're pipe size, so okay. They're designed for standard flow rates. You know, we've had guys with half-mile pivot machines putting 1,400, 1,500 gallons a minute through, an 8-inch pivot.
So it's just it's just that instantaneous pass-through will do what it needs to do?
That's right.
Wow.
That's right.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and we actually have another device meant for high mineral content. And that's designed for extreme, situations. We have a farmer, one of my customers, out in San Ardo, California, and he's got some nasty water. You know, his sulfates are 1,600 milligrams per liter, and the advisory limit is 250.
Hmm.
Hardness, his is 1,300. And anything over 180 is considered very hard. Chloride, sodium is 690. And he said that, if the water, if you'd use overhead irrigation and sprinkle his plants, his crop, you would actually kill the plants.
Hmm.
That's how salty the water was. So we were able actually to bring some relief. You know, we can't turn seawater into drinkable water. It's not desalination. But it does make a huge impact on taking whatever water supply you have and making it work much more efficiently.
Mm.
He said his cattle wouldn't even drink from the troughs before. They would just drink enough to basically survive by putting the unit in. He says he can't keep them away. They drink the water. They love the water.
Wow.
So it's better than what they were used to.
So can this Max H2O thing have an impact on soil health?
Yeah, it does. So, in the same way we break up minerals within the water, we'll actually unbind minerals that have bound up over the years in the soil. So we'll break them up, we'll unbind them, we'll release them, and we'll actually mobilize nutrients, so like calcium, so the plant can take it in and process it. And we've done this with independent studies to show that we're actually mobilizing calcium. The agronomist got very excited about the fact that we're turning something that was a problem in the soil to something that's beneficial. And we've had we've had people reduce their inputs into the farm because we're actually mobilizing some of the good minerals that are in the water or bound up in the soil. And this is can be significant, can be 30% or maybe even 50% the first year once we start turning the soil around. And so it has quite a good impact. We have one property. It's actually a hospital property in Riverton, Utah. And when we started, their pH was 8.2. They put a unit on their main pump station for irrigating the grounds. The next year, it went down to, the pH went to 7.8. And the last year we reported, which was 2017, was 7.5.
Wow.
So we're actually balancing the pH in the soil as well, so changing the chemistry.
Wow. So would you say this result in a reduction of helps in the reduction of fertilizers and inputs to the properties?
Yeah, absolutely. That same Riverton, he reported a 50% reduction in the first year on fertilizers. I had another golf course, and they put a 6-inch in their pump station main, and last year they cut one of the three applications of granular out. And this isn't just him putting his thumb in the air. They actually do biomass analysis off the clippings, and they determine, nope, they only need two applications this year. So he saved, I think it was $5,500 plus the application fee. So that's, you know, it's significant savings in year one, never mind the water savings.
No. So I see a lot of benefits to this thing. I guess I kind of think it could help improve pump efficiency and distribution uniformity with the condition. I'll call it conditioned water. Is that the right term you'd like to use, or is there something better I should be saying?
That's perfect. Yep, it's the transformed water, conditioned water. Yeah, no, you're right. You hit the nail on the head by breaking down those cluster sizes and breaking the surface tension. We'll see a net positive gain in flow rates. So normally it's between 8 and 15%. And it's quite funny because people say, you're going to put this device inside my pipe. And you're going to tell me I'm going to get a net positive gain. You know, they first ask, what's the restriction in flow? And if they know, it's a net positive gain. We actually did a test with a customer in a peach orchard. And he had a traveler, a Cadman traveler, and at 100 PSI in the pump, we were covering 7 rows on each side of the gun. Mm-hmm. We put one of our devices in the discharge of the pump, cranked it up to 100 PSI again, and he was getting 9.5 rows of trees on each side of that gun. So we gained an extra 35-plus feet on the end gun. So I thought he would change the spacing on pulling that gun through the field, and he said, no, it's much simpler. I'm just going to turn the pump down 25% and save fuel and wear and tear on my equipment. So, good solution.
And save him a lot of money as well. So,
yeah, it does. It does.
So,
absolutely.
So, you cover a lot of different industries that specifically benefit from your Max H2O technology, and there's several of them. I mean, there's irrigation, there's ag, there's golf, there's landscape, sports fields. Can you tell us a little about how each of that would affect? Are they all the same things? Meaning you'll get the same results, or do they do special, you know, is it more important for certain industries versus others?
You know, there can be various benefits that would apply to one industry, or maybe it's more important in one industry versus another. But even in farming, you know, depending on, we do farm shows right across North America, Central America, and depending on the location, farmers will have different requirements. It'll either be saving water, or it's saving inputs, or it's better yields. And there's a lot of common threads, but it changes, you know, depending on where the farm is located and what the general conditions are. Mm-hmm. But you know, irrigation is basically healthier crops, turf, plants, and you know, trees, all saving water at the same time and saving input.
It probably helps.
That's the big thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, would it help seed germination as well?
Yeah, it does, actually. You know, it's we have some customers actually putting the dry seed through one of our units before planting. So as they fill their the hopper on their seed or their air drill, they'll actually put the seed through our unit. And because we affect moisture at a molecular level, we're actually affecting that 14% moisture within the corn seed, for instance. And that really kickstarts the germination and starts the protein development. So you combine that with irrigation water, where we're actually permeating through the cellular structure of the seed easier. It's a very powerful combination.
Wow. So I think I read about that you're also involved with livestock, poultry, and dairy, that it solves issues for that market too.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's just about better water, better hydration. It comes down to better hydration. If I could sum it up with a tagline, it's really better hydration, and hydration's a key factor in health, animal health, people. And just better hydration, better delivery of nutrients. We've seen in poultry, turkey barns, we've seen the feed conversion ratio within the first 16 weeks, the first flock that went through, it went from a 1.92 down to a 1.80, meaning, 1.92 pounds of input feed to the bird will produce 1 pound of meat. Well, we cut that down significantly in the first flock, and it's remained solid ever since. Never mind the fact he doesn't get build up the scale on the watering systems and all those benefits as well. Cattle, we see an increase in milk production and component ratios. We actually had a farm up in Nampa, Idaho. The farmer put the unit in the dairy. He didn't tell his vet about it, and a few weeks later, the vet's just scratching his head. He said, I don't understand it. The cows are doing fantastic. And he let it go for a few weeks before he told me put one of our systems in. So it does have a positive impact on animal health.
Wow. And I guess, as we talked earlier, I was thinking of other places you could probably do this in, like in industrial boilers and cooling towers, just like the pumps and what you said earlier. I see you cover a whole gamut of stuff. I'm gonna pass this on to our ag group and also on our residential commercial side of it at our company, because I think it's pretty unique technology, and it ties into a lot of things that we're trying to do. But do you have a system question here? Do you have a system that could connect as a whole house conditioner?
Yeah, the smaller units, 3/4 inch, 1 inch, 1/4, the thread on couplings. We sell a ton of those to residential implementations. Wow. The customers have bad water, have minerals in their water, and it has the same impact within the house and in the garden. They get the same, benefits in the lawn, and pressure washers, not scaling up, don't get the minerals scaling up in the water spots. It's a much healthier solution than using a salt-based softener. There's zero maintenance, it will last a lifetime.
Wow.
And it's good for the environment.
Where can people...
KCAA Loma Linda,